Let's turn now to the next episode in our series on Joseph. Last week we saw how Joseph's wild dreams landed him in that pit, and his brothers sold him off into slavery. But we also caught a few glimpses of another hand at work behind the scenes there, pulling some strings in mysterious ways. God's still bound to this mess, still there with this broken family. In the next chapter here in Genesis, and it's even more disturbing. It's about Judah's scandals and failure to lead. A soap opera we'd have to rate mature, or R at least. The Bible doesn't censure much, really. And so I hate to do this, but we actually have to skip that chapter and move on to the next one now. Pick up the story of Joseph in Genesis 39, where his dream gets going really fast, but almost derailed, first in Egypt. So Genesis 39, let's hear now the word of the Lord. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. The Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord had given him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything that he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and of all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. So Potiphar left everything he had in Joseph's care. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food that he ate. Now Joseph was well built and handsome. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, "Come to bed with me." But he refused. "With me in charge," he told her, "my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns, he has entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even to be with her. One day, he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, "Come to bed with me." But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, she called her household servants. "Look," she said to them, "this Hebrew has been brought to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me, but I screamed. When he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house." She kept his cloak beside her until his master came home. Then she told him this story. "That Hebrew slave you brought us came to me to make sport of me. But as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house." When his master heard the story that his wife told him, saying, "This is how your slave treated me," he burned with anger. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. But while Joseph was there in prison, the Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care, because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. Friends, this is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Well, I still like my title for the message this morning, but I thought of one that I like even better. Joseph gets framed. Joseph gets framed. Because see, I believe that there's not just one way, but two ways in this chapter that Joseph gets framed here, both in a bad way and in a good way. Joseph gets framed for evil and then framed for goodness and for blessing. So which one shall we look at first? The good framing or the bad one? Where should we start our sermon? With the good news or with the bad news here today? Yeah, right, like we'd ever start with the good news. We all know that the bad news is a lot easier to take if we know that there's still good news that's coming. So let's look at how Joseph gets framed first for evil here in verse 7 through 20. If you recall, last week we met a Joseph who was the daddy's boy, the spoiled brat, the naive young dreamer of his family. But this week we see what his brothers couldn't. He's brimming with gifts and bound for success in whatever he leads. In what seems like no time at all, Joseph rises from the pit, from the rank of a slave in Egypt to that of household manager of Potiphar's massive estate. And Potiphar trusts him with pretty much everything, the text says, except the food that he ate, those pleasures that were exclusively his. But then the Bible comments that Joseph was also well-built, a well-built and handsome young man. And that's when we know that trouble is coming. Because the Bible doesn't usually focus on such outward kinds of things. But Potiphar's wife does. She's all eyes for this dreamy young Hebrew and starts stalking him around the house like a cougar, we'd say, ready to pounce on this hunk of meat. It seems not only Joseph, but the dream here is in peril of her worthless, lustful fantasy. But Joseph refuses her relentless advances and resists whatever temptations he might feel. Day after day, she tries to seduce him, but he refuses to be with her in any way. Wise man, we want to say, but that's not what the other slaves there would think. What a fool! When the boss's wife wants you, she gets you. You don't say no to such a powerful Egyptian noble. To do so was probably suicide. It would probably mean your death. Come to bed with me, she orders Joseph, without the least hint of subtlety here. And when still he refuses, she gets violent, grabbing his cloak as if she means to force him right then. But Joseph runs, choosing public scandal over private shame as he leaves his robe there in her hands. He's in such a rush to get out, he flees the house half naked. And see, this then is the point where the framing begins, where Joseph first gets framed. Because Mrs. Potiphar is so furious about his rejection here that she lies to save face and she quickly plots her revenge. Calling on her servants to serve as witnesses, she uses his cloak as material evidence and claims he tried to rape her instead, adding a clever bit of racial profiling there to convince them that he is the villain. Look, this Hebrew has been brought here to make sport of us, she says, shifting the blame on him and claiming her scream of rage was actually a cry for help. How dare this slave reject her, she probably thinks. She'll make him pay for his righteous choice. If she can't have him, well, neither can anyone else. And poor Potiphar, he burns with anger when he hears her story, but against whom? That isn't clear. It could be anger at Joseph, yes, but if he knows his wife well, it could actually be anger at her too, for forcing him to lose his favorite slave. The typical sentence for attempted rape would have been death for a foreigner or a slave then, but Potiphar only throws Joseph here in prison. Perhaps he's unsure, but he's got to defend his honor. I mean, what else can he do? So that's the story of Joseph being framed for evil, for refusing the lesser dreams of Potiphar's wife. And notice, his cloak is used in the deception again, like when his brothers used his first one to lie to their father about his death. But what should we do with this story then? Is it just a moral lesson that we should flee from sexual temptation and that we should hold on to our integrity or our purity at all costs? So it hardly seems fair that Joseph winds up here in prison. Men have loved to moralize on this text because it seems to blame their lust squarely on the woman who made me do it. But if God wanted this to be a simple moral lesson here, you'd think he would have clued us in at how Joseph was feeling it at all, how pretty she was, or how much he struggled within. But he doesn't, because see, that isn't the main point. The main point here is the dream that will stick with Joseph even when others try to deride it or derail it. The story isn't about protecting your purity so much as about being a good servant to others. Because you know what? There's actually more to this story here than just this middle framing, this middle part. There's a wider frame here that puts the focus back where it belongs. Joseph not only gets framed for evil here, but look, he gets framed for good in all the other verses of this chapter. They literally wrap him in the success and blessings of God. See, what we also find in verse 1 to 6 and verse 21 to 23 here is a greater literary frame, a theological one. Twice before, twice after this episode, the narrator declares that the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. Not only in Potiphar's house, but even in prison, Joseph gets set up. He gets framed for goodness, to be a blessing, a great success. No matter how many times he gets knocked down, God's dream will lift him back up. My son designed a great game out of Lego here the other day. It was a game of whack-a-mole. Whack-a-mole. The little Lego balls will pop up, and as quick as you can, you know, you've got to whack them back down. But we start to feel that way about Joseph here in his dream too, don't we? Joseph keeps getting knocked down, but miraculously bouncing back up. It was seems like no time at all. Well, if you're Joseph, I'm sure it felt like a long road, and that it wasn't much fun. I get knocked down, but I get up again. I'm sorry if I got that song stuck in your head. But there is something irresistible about Joseph's gifts here, isn't there? Wherever you plant him, whatever pot you plant him in, it prospers. If not in his own families, then Potiphar's. And if not in Potiphar's, then in the prison. And if not in prison, then, spoiler alert, even Pharaoh's house. It's like his dream can't be smothered, can't be stopped. So what we have here in this chapter is a strange mix, a main story that shows us that though we think that things should get better for the righteous in this world, life can be brutally unfair. It can sometimes be horribly unjust. But we also have a wider frame around that that insists that God is still with Joseph, though he can't see it. So things will get better somehow. Because God is faithful to those who see his dream out. And what ties those two frames together? Well, just loyalty. Yes, loyalty is the bond. The loyalty that we see here in verse 9 and 21. Because in these two verses, both the dreamer and the dream giver refuse to give up on each other, to settle for lesser dreams for themselves. But they stay true to their relationship with each other. So first, look back with me at verse 9. And remember, here's where Joseph is being stalked by this powerful Egyptian who's used to getting what she wants. And sexual promiscuity was all too common in slave cultures then, back then. So had Joseph sought the advice of another slave, they would have told him to do what he was told. He was only a slave, after all. And it was suicide not to give her what she wants. And yet Joseph refuses to act that part of a slave because God and Potiphar have already made him so much more. They've trusted me, he says. They've already put me in charge. He refuses to break all their trust and to sell out his dream for this lesser dream of hers here. And why? Because of his gratitude to Potiphar and to God. As he says, my master has withheld nothing from me except you, his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing? and sinned against God. And that's pretty perceptive for a young man there, isn't it? To recognize that everything he has been given as a trust to bind him to others and to God. That to take more would be a trespass against God. See, personal integrity and common decency may be good reasons not to do this. But Joseph identifies an even more crucial reason for us here in verse 9. This would be a wicked thing to do to my master, he says, because it would violate our relationship of trust. And worse, it would violate my relationship with God. When things are going good in our lives, we often want to take just a little bit more, right? But Joseph resists here. He doesn't tempt fate or test the providence of God. And remember, this is Genesis, so what's happening here is remarkable. A son of Adam is finally turning down the forbidden fruit and trusting that God has made him enough. He was faithful with a little, will also be trusted with much. As Walter Brueggemann says, the clothes do not make this man. It is the dream that makes this man. God's hidden call, God's hidden tug on his life. Whether Joseph was more tempted with pleasure or by the need to protect himself here, he won't betray the dream, God's call, but trust God to clothe him with dignity and honor. But you know, while we might want to say that Joseph's integrity then is the main theme here of this text, the funny thing is not once is it mentioned or praised here by its author. The wider frame here simply credits God with Joseph's success, with his character and his leadership skills, and even with his ability to stay loyal, even his ability to stay true and keep his honor. This passage isn't only about Joseph being faithful, Joseph being loyal to the dream. It's really about God being loyal, the dream being loyal to Joseph. See, God is not loyal to Joseph because Joseph is loyal to him. No, it's the other way around. Joseph is loyal to God because he knows that God's always been faithful to him. The Lord showed Joseph kindness, verse 21 says, and the Hebrew word for kindness is the word chesed, which means God's steadfast, loyal love that never lets go. As the NIV footnote says, though Joseph's situation changed drastically here, God's relationship to him still remained the same. That's what Joseph trusted, what made his misery here manageable. Even as Potiphar's wife frames Joseph with evil and he's thrown in a prison he doesn't deserve, see, God is still at work framing Joseph with good. So her dream for him isn't just refused, it's been overruled here by God's greater dream for his life. His goal to bless Joseph and make him a blessing to his world. But then could our lives be like that too? I mean, do we get framed for bad sometimes? Can life be brutally unfair and unjust? Do even some of our most moral choices only get us more suffering and reward? What do we do then? Can we trust that there's still a wider frame around us, as Joseph did here, where things are getting better, though we can't see it? That God can turn our pits and prisons into good yet, somehow. In his sci-fi book, Ender's Shadow, Orson Scott Card records this dialogue. Do you know why Satan is so angry all the time? Because whenever he works a particularly clever bit of mischief, God uses it to serve his own righteous purposes. So God uses wicked people as his tools. God gives us the freedom to do great evil if we choose. Then he uses his own freedom to create goodness out of that evil, for that is what he chooses. So in the long run, God always wins? Yes. In the short run, though, it can be uncomfortable. Do you see it? Your life is sandwiched. My life is sandwiched in the gracious care of our God. We were made by sheer grace, and we're destined for grace too, restored in the image of God's Son. And so whatever trials we find ourselves in, they are not the end. Don't give in, and don't give up. God is with us in our pits, whether we deserve them or not. In his book, Joseph and the Gospel of Many Colors, pastor and speaker Vadi Bauchem writes this. He writes, most Christians use the word providence, as a substitute for luck. If we swerve our car and miss oncoming traffic, we say, that was providential. Or if the doctor finds our cancer early enough to treat it successfully, we say, that was providential. Again. However, this is not the whole doctrine of providence. The providence of God doesn't just cover the near miss. It also covers the fatal crash and even the terminal diagnosis. God doesn't will those evils, no, but he can weave even the darkest threads into his redemptive plan. God doesn't only orchestrate the things that we find profitable or pleasurable or preferable, Bauchem says, but all things with his good and gracious hand. So sure, one point of this chapter might be to flee temptation, but the even bigger one is really, don't flee all adversity. Because as the Catechism said, God can turn it to our good yet. God is up to something. He is weaving his sovereign purpose out in our lives. So even when others wrong us, he may be giving us some kind of chance. We have something better to serve than just the dreams and schemes here of this broken, hurting world. We have his dream, the gospel of his Son, Jesus. And just think of what Jesus did on the cross. Satan thought that he had him caught there, framed and naked. Who would ever follow such a failure? Who would bow to that son of Joseph, to his kingdom plan, his dream? But God was with Jesus, and Jesus rose up, our steadfast Lord and our faithful Savior forever. And no, the clothes didn't make the man there either. Do you see it? In Jesus, we've all been framed now with a goodness we can never, ever have dreamed of. God credits us with a righteousness better than Joseph, no matter how many times we failed. If we could lose our salvation, we would have, jokes Vadi Bauchem. If it all had relied on Joseph here, then his dream was finished. Thank goodness it doesn't. It simply rests now on Jesus. So friends, let God wrap you with his royal robe now, framed with goodness like his servant Joseph, sealed in Jesus with that love that never lets go. And let that help you in your daily trials, when others frame you or hurt you or harm you. Let it help you to do your best to stay true. Let's pray now. Oh God, take our lives, our everyday lives, and reframe them by your grace. Take our works and help us hang them all on your faithfulness and truth. Through all our testings, Lord, somehow make our journeys, bring a blessing to others, and draw us near to Jesus and to you. In Christ's name we ask this, and for the sake of his kingdom, God's people say together,